Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match. With Indeed. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey everyone, welcome to a special episode of Remap Radio. We have been really lucky to have a lot of folks come through back at Waypoint and now here at Remap. You know I love doing interviews. I love talking to folks in and around the games industry, and to have an opportunity to continue doing that here at Remap has been great. And I am excited to be joined not only by my colleague Rob Zachney. Rob, hi.
Hello, hello.
But also the founder and CEO of Ascendant Studios, the game director of Immortals of Avium, a former creative director across several Call of Duty games, although, I mean, most notably, perhaps, Dead Space 2008, which you might have seen Rob and I play the remake and the original game side by side over a course of many Twitch streams. But, Brett, I mean, there are so many things that we could talk about, but I really don't know how we could start anywhere but your work as a designer on Gex Enter the Gecko. I mean, I feel like it all starts there. So how does where we get today begin with your work on Gex?
That's funny. Well, first off, good to talk to you guys. I appreciate you having me. Yeah, Gex 2 Enter the Gecko. That was my first design job. I was a junior level designer, and it was for PlayStation 1, which dates me quite a bit. And it was a great job, actually. Crystal Dynamics back then was a crazy place. It was, kind of the inmates were running the asylum. We were all kind of, young, crazy game makers. And it was just a really fun game to make. Actually, a lot of that Gex team went on to found Naughty Dog. And so if you look at the credits of Gex 2, you see, guys like Evan Wells and Bruce Straley and a lot of other names that are now, very, very familiar to everyone. But those are all my buddies working on that game. It was a lot of fun. So then, I did a few games at Crystal, and then I went to EA and did a few games there. Return of the King and From Russia with Love, and then like you said, Dead Space.
We were fortunate to be able to talk with you last year, which feels like a lifetime ago. I'm sure for you as well, as for you launched a game, we lost our jobs, lots of things happened last year for many of us. But I guess in the big picture, now that we're 6-ish months out from the launch of Immortals, a lot's happened to you, to the studio, to the games industry. Like, how do you feel about how that period went for the launch of the game now that you have a little bit of hindsight?
Yeah, it was a roller coaster, and I've never been through a launch like that. I've worked on a lot of big games, a lot of known franchises. You know, launching a new IP is hard, and I didn't realize how hard it was. You know, this has been a crazy year. It's a kind of a murderer's row of games that came out right when we came out, and we got totally lost, I think, in that market timing. We had Baldur's Gate 3 come out right before us. We had Starfield come out right after us. And when you're a new IP from a new studio that no one had ever heard of, like cutting through that noise, trying to get that awareness built was super hard. So yeah, it was rough. It was a rough launch. We didn't sell the way we wanted to sell. But the game, you know, the game was reviewed well, and you know, hopefully you guys felt this way when you played it, but like, it's a good game. It's a solid game. I think there's some things about it that are great. So, you know, we are, these things, they kind of have a life of their own when they leave, they leave your hands. And, I saw this happen with Dead Space. Dead Space didn't sell that well at first, kind of grew some momentum over time. I think Immortals could be one of those games people keep talking about or keep discovering over time, because it was, you know, it's a passion project. And you just don't get a lot of those, especially at that budget level, anymore. So I love the game. I'm very proud of it.
So I'm curious, is the reception of a game like this a surprise to you before you, like at the time you launch, or is it a situation where there's a creeping suspicion about how launch is going to go and just where you're at in terms of like the game's marketing, how audiences are sort of primed or not primed to like accept it? I'm just curious, like, did you kind of already have a feeling it was going to play out the way it did, or is it always kind of a surprise what happens on launch day and after?
It was a surprise. I think we knew that awareness for the game was fairly low because we had some metrics around that we were tracking. It's on the marketing side. Quite honestly, I think awareness is still kind of low. I think some people are still discovering, there was a game called Immortals of Avium. So, you know, which is unfortunate, but it's true. So we knew that. And we knew that the landscape was a minefield with, you know, what was happening with Baldur's Gate, with Armored Core at the same week as us, Starfield the next week, all that kind of stuff. Those things we knew, but, you know, hope springs eternal. And you know, we figured, we still got a good shot at this. So there was definitely a surprise. On the critical side, that was also a surprise to me because I don't know, you know, if you look at the critical reception of the game, like we got tens and we got fours, and I've almost never seen that before. I think, you know, again, it's kind of, to me, this comes back to what it means to launch a new IP. People didn't know what to expect coming into the game, and you can very easily get quite honestly, you get the wrong people, or not the wrong people, but people that aren't going to be, you know, amenable to the game reviewing it. And I never had that on something like Call of Duty. Like Call of Duty, we would be within a certain range. I think because reviewers knew what to expect. They knew, this is Call of Duty. Okay. You know, yeah, I don't like this about it, but I knew that was happening. Oh, they did this kind of well. You know, you're kind of within a certain range. We were all over the map. And I think you just got people coming in going like, what is this game? This isn't what I expected at all. And other people going like, oh my God, I love this game. This is exactly why don't they make more of these type of games? So yeah, very, very bizarre. And it also kind of shows where Metacritic has come over time. It's changed quite a bit, I think, or just review scores in general have changed over the time that I've been making games. I guess the good news is user scores are really high. People that actually play the game and discover it really like it. We did this free trial where you could, you know, play a couple hours and then and then, you know, buy the game if you like it. And our conversion rate on that is super high, way higher than what EA is used to seeing. So, you know, there are good, really good things. I think when people play it, by and large, they tend to like it.
What is some of the difference on, you know, kind of building a Rob's question, on the awareness you have going into a launch? Obviously, I'm sure the kind of metrics you have going into, you know, like a game like Dead Space, way different than the metrics you have going into a game like Immortals. But like, what is that? Like, what were those two kind of launches like for you in terms of what your expectations were, or even like what expectations from, I don't know, like marketing, like, and I'm sure on some level marketing can kind of give you a sense. Here's what we kind of think is going to happen. And like, just what is that different level of awareness? What are you tracking differently, like over the course of these essentially like different decades in which these games both launched?
Yeah. I mean, I, you know, on Dead Space, I wasn't nearly as in touch with, the marketing. I was sort of, you know, a little bit removed from that. And I do remember that EA at the time, they actually kind of cut our marketing a bit and didn't, they weren't sure about Dead Space at all at the time. We were coming out right at the same time as another game, Mirror's Edge. Mm-hmm. And they kind of doubled down on that more than Dead Space. In a weird way, I think it kind of helped us because we became a game that people discovered on their own. And there was a huge sort of groundswell and like word of mouth of like, holy shit, have you seen this game? This game's awesome. So, you know, maybe they did us a favor in the long run. I knew at the time with Dead Space, there was uncertainty and like, we don't know where this is going to land. So in that way, it was similar to Immortals where we didn't know. We hoped it would hit well. But at the end of the day, you don't know until you launch what's actually going to happen. There's so many factors, you know, at play. So, yeah, it's interesting.
Well, just to the point about reviews, I was actually struck by how odd the landscape has gotten to, because I also eventually, like, I'd read a few reviews when it came out, or read a few more to refresh myself, but then I went to Metacritic, and to a degree, it kind of reflects, like, not to say that, like, a bunch of smaller, less well-known sites, like, have less valid opinions, but it's like, it used to be that, like, there were a lot of major outlets, and they would all review a lot of games, so you'd have a broad sample size of, like, just in general, how they're reacting to games, and that was a big part of the sample size that Metacritic reflects. And now when I scroll through Metacritic, it's like a handful of sites that I know I've been reading for years. And then a lot of like smaller games blogs that are coming in reviewing this from a variety of angles. But it is a real mix just in terms of like the sample size that Metacritic is drawing. I think also you're onto something when you say it's different from like Call of Duty. I feel like things in, when it comes down to like review assignments, the advantage, it can cut both ways, but the advantage a thing like Call of Duty has is if a series goes on long enough, editors just start farming it out to like, oh, we got a Call of Duty person that we're gonna hand this to. You care about these games.
Right.
They're never going to let someone like me or Patrick at a Call of Duty game because like we don't play enough of the series really to be abreast of how it's changing. And in a weird way, that ends up like predisposing the review one way or another. Like you have someone who's like, I'm already invested in Call of Duty. It can also mean you'll get someone who hates the changes to the formula, like disproportionately. But in general, yes, like a lot of franchises have this advantage where they're handed to reviewers who are already coming to it from the perspective of like, they're pretty bought in. I think your instinct about like Avium being kind of thrown to whoever, and that doesn't mean like people who shouldn't have reviewed it, but it means that I know these things are handed out, right? You're just going through who is available to review this. Do you play shooters? And that's a really broad question. And then you start getting a lot of reactions from people who just don't have any expectations shaped. And a lot of the reviews, the negative reviews I found were like, they seem to be about the tone of the game. That seemed to be the big sticking point. And I kind of liked it, but that's just the ultimate subjective thing, right? Where in general, the thing that seems pretty consistent is people dug the combat overall. Like, hey, the three magic system, the way combat works, that's all pretty neat. the part that seemed really divisive was just like the tone and tenor of the game.
Yep. Yeah, no, for sure. Well, yeah, I mean, getting back to what you're saying about, you know, reviewer assignments, 100%. You're not going to get, you know, a driving game comes out. You're not going to hand it to someone who doesn't like driving games. Or, you know, I think we saw this happen quite a bit. And these are amazing games. But like with the FromSoft games, like something like Elden Ring getting a 97, like, I love Elden Ring. I'm a huge fan. But that is a polarizing experience for a lot of people. And, you know, I'm sure it was like, raise your hand if you want to, you know, review a FromSoft game, you know, because it's a certain type of gamer that's going to, you know, jump in on that and love what they're doing. You need a little bit of background and experience there. So yeah, when you have a new IP, something no one's heard of, and maybe a somewhat confused marketing campaign where you're like, okay, is this Call of Duty with magic? Is this God of War? Like, what is, you know, is it Doom? Like, what is this game? You're not going to get that consensus on it, you know?
I had a question about that, because I remember, Patrick, early on, we first started talking about this in the wake of, we were talking about this in the Waypoint days, right? Like, I think mm-hmm. it might have been E3 or whatever the equivalent was, like 2 years ago. But like, this game came up, and I remember either you framed it this way, or when I looked up, I came across this idea that it was like Wizard Call of Duty. And that sort of stuck in my head.
Yeah.
And which never sounded like the most appetizing thing in the world to me, because I like shooters, but I think for a lot of reasons I fell off Call of Duty campaigns. Mm-hmm. And actually, I think playing Avium clarified for me what it is that I am missing in shooters like that. But we'll come to that. But I was sort of struck by the degree to which, after playing Avium, Wizard Call of Duty didn't quite fit. I was kind of surprised the degree to which, like, oh, that's just not... That's not yeah. really what's going on here, yeah. but it was a thing that I'd heard a lot in the year before the game came out.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. And I think that was a misfire, in my opinion.
Because where does that come from, though? Like, I'm just from the stand, like, I'm not asking you, like, what marketer yeah. do we need to throw under the bus? Let's find that guy. But I am curious, like, that idea originates from somewhere. And I'm curious, sure. like, in from your view, when does that start bubbling out as a thing that ends up being some of the messaging around the game?
Well, you know, whenever you're talking about a new IP, any game really, you're using an elevator pitch a lot of times. And you're just kind of, you're using a shorthand for how to describe it. And you're describing it to people, all sorts of people that don't, you know, necessarily know about what you're doing. So like, Call of Duty Magic or Fantasy Call of Duty or things like that, it's just a nice shorthand to use to kind of go, oh, okay, I'm shooting. It's a first-person shooter, but it's magic instead of guns. So I think it was like kind of a term used quite a, you know, kind of around the studio and around, you know, and just to describe the game to some degree. And then it kind of seeped into the marketing to a certain degree. Obviously, the fact that I spent 9 years and, you know, shipped 3 Call of Duty titles as a creative director lend itself to making that comparison to some degree. But, you know, early on in interviews and things, I was quick to point out, like, we're not Call of Duty. Like, we're not trying to make a fantasy Call of Duty. We're actually something else. And, you know, now when I look at it, I almost think it's like, you know, Doom Eternal and God of War had a baby and Immortals came out, you know, it's like, we're kind of like this arena shooter, fast-paced, crazy action, but we also have Metroidvania exploration and puzzles and world building and things like that. So, but I mean, that's part of being making a new IP is like you're discovering that as you're making the game. I didn't really have a strong template for what the game was going to be 5 years ago when I started it. I was, you know, I knew I wanted to do a first-person shooter and I knew I wanted to do magic, but like, what the game ultimately ended up being was a discovery over 5 years. And it changed over time and it shifted and, you know, moved and everything. Something like Dead Space, I had a much clearer idea. Dead Space was Resident Evil 4 in space. And we had a very strong template for what, you know, I had a very strong template for what I wanted to do design wise. Immortals wasn't like that. Immortals was like, okay, we're going to take a piece of this, a piece of that. We're going to change this. We're going to, like, you know, do some heavy experimentation on tone for a fantasy game. You brought up tone earlier. Like, that was a huge risk that we took. And, you know, we're going to take all these pieces and put them in a blender and see what happens. So, yeah, using something like Call of Duty Magic is a good shorthand maybe to start with. But then really where we evolved to, I feel like we should have targeted more, and we still are, like, action adventure and, you know, people that like fantasy and people like a big action game. It doesn't have to be a shooter. It doesn't have to be guns. It doesn't have to be Call of Duty. It's, I think, a little bit broader than that.
Because of the sheer sort of length that it takes to make, you know, you mentioned this is a game that you discovered over the course of 5 years, but naturally, eventually things have to start calcifying into place because you need to ship the thing and you need to start figuring out what is this, where because of the very nature, scope, budget, length of time to make games of this scope these days, is that discovery process harder? Because at a certain point, you have to just be happy with what you have, as opposed to this is the thing that it was always going to be. But at some point, it has to be, well, this is the thing it is, so that we can hand this off to an art team and to a production team. And you know, every piece of art, game or otherwise, is an incomplete, you get as far as you can, put it into the world, and maybe you're blessed with making a sequel or something else where you can iterate. But I do wonder if, like, your process in discovering that is itself reflective of a lot of the problems with AAA game development these days, which is just, it's super expensive, it takes forever, and thus ends up making sort of the risk-taking process a challenge because just of the sheer scope of everything.
It does. You know, I've done AAA pretty much my whole career, and you tend to be pretty risk adverse and pretty, you know, it does put a clamp down on experimentation and going, you know, down certain roads for too long, because ultimately you're burning a lot of money. You've got a lot of people working on this, and you need to, you know, you need to go with things that you know are going to work. And I think that it does hurt AAA games. I think the arms race of costs, it's only growing. It's only making things harder. It's only making publishers and investors more risk adverse because of the costs involved. And that it's a bummer. I mean, I think, you know, we were a small, scrappy team for a long time, and we put together a prototype that was really strong with a small team, and that was great.
What's small? Because I just to give people the scale, like the scale, like what is small for a game that eventually becomes sort of like, you know, a tentpole AAA game? Like, what is, how many people is small?
For the first 2 years, we were about 40 people.
Okay,
and that first, I mean, when I started the company, we were one. It was just me. It wasn't a case of me like, hey, I got, you know, 20 people that I'm pulling from a company or that I'm friends with, and suddenly we're making a studio. It was just me. So the first year it was like, it was one, then it was four, then it was 10, then it was 20. And by the time we finished the second year, we were maybe at 40 or 45. And around then we had gotten to a prototype that was awesome. That was like, okay, this is the combat. This is how the game's going to feel. And we can build a game. That's the foundation. We can build a game around that. So yeah, but that's, you know, 40 people, but that, you know, that's a few million in when you know, to get there, but it's not 50 million in, it's not, you know, 40 million. So I think the longer you can stay in that mode and get that experimentation and, you know, fail fast and, you know, take risks and do all those things you're supposed to do, the longer you can stay in that before the sort of production machine comes in and you need all the people to make it into something huge and beautiful, you know, the better. And we were fortunate in that I could do that for a while. Like a lot of games I've worked on, you know, you start day one with a big team because you just rolled off of a game. You got all, you know, it's like, shit, you got to make decisions real fast and get, and
you gotta
get
give going. People something to do.
Exactly. Yeah. You got to, you know, we call it feeding the beast. You got to feed the beast quickly, you know. And that can hurt you design wise. And I think every big publisher and every big franchise we look at, they deal with that. You know, they have to, I made those games. You deal with like, okay, we're not, you know, we're incrementing 10, 20%. We're not getting too crazy or adventurous with the game design. Unless like, you know, they're really at a point where they're rebooting or doing something drastic, but man, you know, it's so risky. It's so risky to do that kind of shit. So yeah, I mean, we took our time with just getting the core down. And then once that was there, like we really made Immortals in basically, I would say, 2 years. Like all the content that you see, all the cinematics, all the levels, the, you know, the gear, all the stuff that's in it was two and a half years, maybe, once we gotten that foundation figured out.
Which feels pretty short relative to the turnaround time that, you know, I think your average God of War or, you know, kind of the Sony scale sort of like story driven stuff is, those are not two and a half years. Those are true, you know, 4-5 year productions.
Yeah. I mean, on Call of Duty, we, you know, it'd be 3 years on the ones I made, at least for 3 years. Mm-hmm. And you had a team of 150, 200 day one. So you're going, you know, and that's like 3 years of solid development. We did this pretty quickly. And we were still hiring during it. Oh, and there was a pandemic too. So.
And were you remote? Remote first, or did you remote adapt as COVID set in?
We remote adapted. We were absolutely local. Everyone was in an office. On, you know, March 2020, we were all in an office, and April 2020, we're all at home. And then
how did that shift throughout the course of finishing the game? Did that kind of fundamentally alter the studio and the production along the way?
100%. Yeah, no, we did, you know, it was completely hiring remote. We hired very few local at that point. We grew from, you know, 40 to 115 or whatever our peak internal was. And it was all these, you know, learning how to make a game remotely. I'd never done it before. So, you know, really leveraging, you know, software and certain types of practices and processes that we needed to survive to even figure out how to do it. So there was a lot of making it up as we went along.
Did you like making it remotely? Like, what was different about that process? Like, how did you arrive at feeling good about the day-to-day as you were figuring that part out?
There's things I like, and we're still remote. So there's things I like about it. What I find is I'm able to, because of Slack and because I'm kind of, you know, more dialed into all the conversations that are happening on a daily basis, I'm able to kind of see a broader amount of the game as a game director than I did when we were all local, because I'd be in a meeting room, and that meeting room's about a single topic, and I'm sitting there talking about it for an hour and a half. Well, I've got, you know, 15 things going on in Slack, and I'm touching and able to see all of them. There's, you know, it's just a different way of thinking, and that helps me to, you know, in terms of coordination and direction. What I didn't like about it was finaling the game. Finaling the game remotely sucked. And I think there's something about being together, having all the leads in the same room, playing the game together, hours and hours and hours, talking about it, prioritizing. Like, I've closed every single game that way. We usually have what we call like a war room or something where, you know, a bunch of us are sitting there just like really hammering on it for the last, you know, 4 or 6 months. And having to do that remotely was not great.
Did you try and create like a war room equivalent? Like, were you even able to, like, okay, so it was a Slack channel that everyone was just broadcasting their playthroughs? Like, how did you try and recapture that atmosphere then?
It was exactly that. You know, I think we were doing, I can't remember if it was Discord or Twitch, because they stream well, but we were just playing, streaming together, talking, but still something's lost not being together. It's just, yeah, it's an intangible thing that I think you know, it's hard. I think I'm sure I'm not the only game director, you know, that feels this way about trying to close a game these days. It's different, but you know, it's also something we can get better at and figure out. It's not insurmountable. It's just different. I've been doing this 27 years. It was the first time I really had to do that. So it was kind of crazy.
Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season 2 of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me season 2 is out now from Lemonada Media.
I want to tell you a story. It's a story about a scandal, broken relationships, gossip, rumors, money, corporate rivalry, and a broom. A performance-enhancing broom. My name is John Cullen. I'm a comedian, podcaster, and for 20 years, I was a semi-professional curler. And I want to tell you the story about how a single broom almost imploded the 500-year-old sport of curling.
We felt like we were bringing a knife to a gunfight.
It's the story of a superstar and his fall from grace.
Well, I was being dragged through the mud.
It's the story of two brother entrepreneurs with a dream.
I said, that's great news.
It's a story of intrigue.
I still don't understand why we want to keep his name secret.
The full story has never been told, so I'm going to tell it. Broomgate, how a broom almost killed curling.
It was a year I'd like to forget.
To listen to Broomgate, search for Broomgate in your favorite podcast app. That's all one word, Broomgate.
I am curious, just in terms of, we're talking about like staff and budgets, to what degree is, we're talking like burn rate, what are the meaningful costs beyond headcount at this point for a studio like yours? Like how big a burden is the office space to carry, the physical and electronic infrastructure that you've got to carry? Like, I'm just curious, to what degree is burn rate basically just, we're talking about headcount, and to what degree is it things like leases and infrastructure and licenses, et cetera?
Yeah, I think, you know, it depends on what you're doing. If you're like things like office space and server costs and software costs, that's all real. Like there's some real money there. It's, you know, I think if you're like the server costs can get pretty high, especially if you're doing multiplayer or something. Mostly it's the people. Most of your burn rates, the people, the devs, the people that are working on the game. I don't know what the percentage is. It depends on the size and your scale and everything. We have an office. We pay rent on an office. We have, you know, lots of software licenses we have to pay for. We have, services we pay for and all that, and, you know, servers and things. Largely the burn rate is people. As it should be. Like that's kind of why, where you want to spend your money is on, you know, great developers.
But like then when we talk about the sort of 40 person team that's kind of the core, like figuring out what the next thing is, it also kind of points to, not to say that this is why all these layoffs are happening that we're seeing across the industry, but like in general, we're talking about the sort of recurring endemic layoffs we see to the industry. It seems like there's a real tension between like the staff you need to finish a game versus like the staff you need to get a project teed up for the full production. And like, you know, obviously, you know, if there's a world where Immortals of Avium is the hit of 2023 and everything's golden, maybe you have the runway to like, you know, retain all those people and then have that like Skunk Works team or whatever go forward. But it does seem like there's inherent tension between the, you know, dozens of people you really need to figure out what a game is and what direction it's going, and then the hundreds you need to deliver a AAA game.
Yeah, it's sort of in the nature of the beast is that you need a lot of people to finish. You don't need a lot of people to start. you know, every project I've been on has had that sort of push and pull and sort of a little bit of an accordion. If you're in a big company with multiple games, you tend to go, okay, well, now work on this game for a while. And, you know, you can move people around and do things like that. You know, for us, we have one game and it didn't sell. So it's like, okay, there's only, you know, really one thing we could do at that point. Unfortunately, it was layoffs, which really sucked. You know, it's like you said that, if the game had been a hit, we wouldn't obviously would not have had to do that.
Well, but I'm curious, like, would you have been spared that? Because I think the other thing that happened is the investment, like, landscape also changed a lot. Like, even if this had been a success, most people were modest, say it had been a decent success, but not, you know, game of the year, whatever.
Right.
But, you know, you would have still then, as an independent studio, it's not like you can just go, you know, it's not like you can go and say, like, okay, what EA project can we support develop here, you know, to keep the wheels turning. Even if it's been a success, you would have still needed to go back into pitch mode, right, to, like, conceive and sell the next project. Like, do you think there's any, like, it sort of seems like in a situation like that, layoffs are inevitable. The size of them is determined by how well the project does, but it does seem like it's a really difficult thing to avoid, just given that reality, especially for an independent studio where in this market you got to go be a pitch man again.
Yeah, and it's a rough market to do that in right now, as we see, as we've all seen. I mean, sure, we might have been in that position anyway. I think, you know, it helps to have as much runway as possible when you're doing these kind of deals. I think, you know, I'm not a financial expert or business expert by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, I think the obvious trends we're seeing are we had a huge amount of investment coming in during COVID. COVID changed, you know, everything. It changed player patterns. It changed engagement. And a lot of money came in. And then that, you know, that money kind of went away with COVID going away, and people went back to normal patterns and behaviors. And that investment, you know, a glut of investment started not to pay off for people. And then at the same time, you get the interest rates going up, and suddenly money isn't moving nearly as much. And it's suddenly hard to, you know, to get funding for anything. And those two things, you know, you get that collision of those two things, people have to reduce costs, and it sucks, and we see it every single day right now. And there might be other factors at play as well, but those seem like the big ones, is, you know, cost of money and a complete, like, a radical change in player behavior and in investment over the last 3 years. So yeah, it's a rough. It's definitely a rough environment, but, you know, my opinion, games are still absolutely where people should invest in, because it's growing. People are playing. You know, people aren't not playing. You know, and this is one of the biggest years ever for games, especially AAA. It's like 2023 was incredible. So it's a little schizophrenic when you're thinking of how successful those games are, and then you see layoffs every single day. But I think one is trailing the other, and, you know, we'll get out of it. You know, may not be right away, but we'll get out of it.
The industry will, but like it's the sort of, you know, people caught in the churn. But
yes,
when you have that, you know, when we talk about that aspect of it, you know, I assume you knew pretty fast after launch that this was not breaking your way. That this was not going to live up to expectations. I'm curious, is that a moment, like, in your heart, like, do you know at that point, like, layoffs are inevitable, or is there a period where you're not making that call and you're trying to, like, see things play out and see if things turn?
I knew pretty quickly it was inevitable, like after launch, pretty quickly after launch, that it was, okay, we have a problem. We're going to have to do something about this. So, you know, and once you realize that, I think it's, it's better just to move fast and just kind of do it and not have a lot of people worried and waiting and wondering. It's more just like, okay, look, here's the situation. Here's what we have to do. I think we're painting a fairly grim picture. I do want to add that like Immortals has actually been selling really well in December, and things things are not that's a complete disaster. So it's worth mentioning that. It was a rough time. And certainly the first time in my life, I'd always been a creative director and, worked for big companies and things like that. It's the first time I really had to be the guy doing the layoffs. So not a fun time.
One moment I was interested in returning to was, the kind of uh-oh moment for me in the game was when you took the delay from July to August, mm-hmm. just in terms of, you mentioned at the top the kinds of games that you got kind of sandwiched by the time you came out at the end of the summer. And it's, I remember seeing that and going, well, these games are brutal towards the end of mm-hmm. like, it'd be very natural to take that extra time. Lots of games don't take that extra time, or there's a day one or day one-ish, patch that essentially becomes that like 6 to 8 weeks of extra runway in order to get that extra layer of polish and get the game out the door. So I have to imagine you knew on some level that shifting from late July, where there was a lot going on all the time last year, but certainly late July was different than late August, and how you arrived at realizing this is necessary for the game, even if it puts us in a more compromised release position.
Yeah, that decision was 100% around quality. So this is our first game as a new studio. This is, you get one shot to make a great first impression. That was an extra month of bug fixing, optimization, making the game better. And that was actually huge. It was at the time, 100% the right thing to do, because the game's better for it. And I would rather I took the risk of, releasing a more broken game during a more amenable window versus a better game in a harder window. And, I don't know what the right, hindsight, who knows? I do know that at the end of the day, as a studio, we're gonna hang our hat on quality and want to create, the best experience we can for players. That was super important to me, more important than trying to read the tea leaves around a launch window. That really hard to do. What was in my control and in hand was making a better game. So that, it was almost an easy decision for that.
Did you, because of the relationship you had as like an EA original as opposed to an EA published game, often delays are publisher mandated, or negotiation with them. Was that something that you were actually able to make the call on due to the different kind of relationship you had? Whereas I could imagine a different scenario where, hey, ship the damn game and you find a way to ship it in July. But I'm sort of picking up on that, like, this was something you actually got to make the call on rather than, somebody at a executive publisher saying, get it out the door. The numbers are more important.
Yeah. I mean, we had a good relationship with EA and, their production team and everything. We talked every day. And this was a mutual decision. I mean, they certainly wanted the game to be higher, as high quality as it could be. We had that conversation, is it higher quality and worse window, lower quality, better window? They were on board with that. It certainly wasn't a case of them mandating anything. Worth mentioning or repeating that, we funded Immortals. This is not an EA game. This is an Ascendant right. game and everything. So ultimately the decision was ours. But it, there wasn't a lot of friction there. There wasn't a lot of like, what are you doing? You know, kind of thing. It was like, no, they advised that. We saw it. I saw it as like, okay, that's, you know, that's better for the game ultimately. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think that quality mattered. You know, we have an average user score of 80 right now. We have, you know, we got eights and nines from big outlets. We got eight and eight from IGN. We have a lot of, you know, publishers and industry partners that want to work with us now. Like all of that is about, you know, ensuring or trying our best to make sure that Ascendant had a great first showing and, you know, and showed that like, well, we can make quality games. And that was super important, maybe more important than what was happening exactly in 2023.
That seems super unforgiving, because I think the delay seems like it made all the sense in the world, and the game does run great. Like it, a game like that, especially going to live and die by how smooth it is, and just in terms of how it feels. And I'm consistently sort of surprised at how fast, how nimble the entire thing feels. But I'm also sitting here being like, man, if this had come out in January, I think a lot of people would be talking about Immortals of Avium.
Which is what Rob and I ended up doing, which was like, it became like, you know, an ongoing bit. It was like, I really liked those couple hours. I was really impressed out of the gate when I played at Summer Games Fest. You know, yeah. I thought, you know, I was a huge fan of the Doom reboot from years back. And I was like, I'm picking up on Doom vibes from this game, almost purely based on the speed, right? Like, it's just so different to play a game in which the player character moves that fast. Like, I, you know, we're all used to that, having played games, for, you know, shooters from the 90s in which your default speed was the speed of a Ferrari. But, you know, yeah. Halo comes around and essentially moves us all into a tank mode. And then different games have kind of just, are you, how much faster are you are than Halo? And so that game stuck out to me originally just based on its speed alone. And then, yeah, like I started playing it over the holidays, and then and messaged Rob. I was like, hey, like it was not a bit, you know, like I'm choosing to spend, you know, 16 to 20 hours of my holiday time playing through this game because I was having a really great time with it.
That's awesome. I by the way, I'd love to talk about some of the game with you guys.
Oh, for sure. Yeah,
again. Which would be awesome. But yeah, I mean, you know, hindsight's 2020, and I think January would have been awesome, all things considered. Now, you have financial considerations, you know, it takes money to get from August to January, and, you know, quite a bit of money when you have a big team. So
you can't just put your entire studio in like suspended animation.
Exactly.
Like waiting for the, yeah.
Yeah. Waiting for the perfect time. That's, you know, that's the friction, and that, you know, that's the, and that ultimately is the decision is like, well, what's better, you know, a better window, or, you know, are we going to spend this much money to get that better window? And is that worth it? And it's like, hard to say, hard to predict. But what we did see, and we continue to see, and exactly what you're saying is, looks really cool. When I have time, I want to play it. Looks really cool. When it's on sale, I'm going to play it. And, you know, and now the game's on sale. And sure enough, we've seen a huge uptick in sales because of the price. And the price is interesting. You know, like, there is an argument to be made that maybe we should have come out at a lower price point.
What's it at right now? Because I haven't followed this.
I think we're half off. I'm pretty sure we're half off.
And that follows the trial that you did in the fall, right?
Yep. Yep, exactly. Yeah, we're half off. So
that's... I mean, I think it probably speaks to, you know, the broader challenges yes, last year was, I think, a particular glut of COVID-delayed games, a lot of them then finally arriving in 2023 and just this collision course. But it is probably also true, you know, we started this conversation talking a lot about reviews, that just how to communicate with audience these days when they are overwhelmed by choice. I mean, I see this with my own kids, right? Where, yeah. You know, when they're on an iPad, it's like, it's not, oh, it's video game time. It's like, well, it could be Netflix time or Disney Plus time or Roblox, you know what I mean? And so it's just the glut of choice makes it, I think, all the more challenging to figure out how you reach an audience, because I don't think it's as simple these days as get glowing reviews, like have good trailers, and then the game will sell well. It's just not, it was never that simple. I'm oversimplifying like how games were successful, but
yeah,
there were elements of that in place that like played a part in a game being successful that is less true these days.
100%. I mean, there's so much noise out there. There's so many things, you know, competing for attention more so than ever before. And you've got, you know, there needs to be a certain stickiness where, you know, we spent good money on our marketing campaign. We got ads out there, but they're not going to stick unless there's something about it that really grabs you. Like when you hear about a game coming out from a studio you love, like Naughty Dog or something, it sticks. It's just like, oh, I got to remember that. That's, what are they up to? That's cool, you know? And we were unknown. And so that makes the stickiness, I think, harder. Trying to vie for that attention is super hard. You know, now we've built up some attention. Now with things like the free trial, like the amount of people that are actually able to access and look at the game has grown a lot. And as soon as we went on sale, like our sales, five times more, you know, mm-hmm. it was a huge amount of boost. And it's sort of like playing is believing. Once people actually get their hands on it and start to play, they go, oh, wait a minute. Like, this game's kind of awesome. Like, you know, how did I miss this one? So I'm hoping that continues for a long time.
Well, you know, playing it, I can also see, even in terms of, you know, we draw the Doom comparison, and I'm like, that's not quite right either, though, because yeah. Doom doesn't require nearly as much walking and chewing bubble gum as this game does, where it's like, I have been sort of taken aback by how many times I've like sort of sitting there staring at the death screen being like, okay, I need to really cycle through the powers more effectively. I got to start. I got to remember to use the lash and the limpet. And like there's a lot of that in the combat where there's a lot of systems you're manipulating. There's a lot of resources you're managing at a very high rate of speed, which makes it really engaging, really fun. But also means that, you know, one advantage that Doom always had, and I think this, you know, if you read reviews from when Doom 2016 came out, right? Because it's Doom, people are like, man, this is a return to classic run and gun action. And it's really not like new Doom is not really that much like old Doom. It's just a vibe. Right. But right. That vibe communicates a lot. A game like this, I'm like struggling to be like, well, yeah, it is kind of like Doom. You know, it's kind of like Wolfenstein. There's a little bit of maybe some like BioShock. Yep. But there's a lot of pieces to it. And it's one of those things where, you know, to your point, you do kind of have to get hands on with it to feel it, because it doesn't film well. Right. I think it's a problem right. with a lot of, you know, every time I see, game trailers and such at, you know, things like the Game Awards, anytime you're doing anything different, you run into a real problem of like, how do you explain why this thing might look like something else, but isn't going to feel like something else? And that seems really tricky.
That's new IP, right? Yeah. Like that's like you're doing something different, and that immediately makes things harder for people to understand, for you to message. When our first gameplay trailers came out, people didn't know what the hell they were looking at. You know, oh, is it, you know, like it, you know, how does it play? There's a lot of, you know, special effects going off, like all this, you know, things that actually when you play it aren't that much of an issue, but they, you know, what they were seeing was they hadn't seen things like this before.
And the game snapped into place for me when I finally played it. It's like I was right. when looking at the trailer, I was like, I think I can parse what's happening here, but there are some games, it's a little easier for us because, you know, we've done this for a long time. I'm used to seeing trailers and the trickiness and conveying new ideas.
Right.
But it was just why when I went to Summer Games Fest, I was like, all right, everything about this game 100% makes sense to me now. And I can backtrack it to the trailers and even the challenges the trailers had having played it. And it's like, it's less complicated. I mean, it's more complicated in the way that Rob said, like, there's a lot of systems going on, but it's actually not that complicated once you've got it in front of you with the controller. And then it all kind of snaps into place and you know how you're kind of vibing through the different areas.
Right. Right. And it does take playing it to kind of get that. And, you know, I wasn't really interested in making something that was a clone of something else. We tried to do some new things here. And that, you know, that runs, you run a risk of people not understanding it, people having, you know, or weird messaging around it. But ultimately, like, right, that's more interesting. Like that's more fun to me. I'd rather play something different once in a while. And yeah, the combat and the feel of the game, I will say, has been like the overwhelming success of the game. And certainly, like, even the reviews that you know, bang, you know, ding the game for other things, they would admit that like the game's really fun to play and the combat's really fun. You get into more polarizing waters when you talk about the writing and the tone, and maybe, you know, maybe some of the gear system and things like that, which, you know, certainly that to me is an interesting design discussion to have is, okay, what worked? Why did it work? What didn't work? That's what I enjoy talking about because, you know, it's the same discussion you'd be having. Like I have problems with the latest God of War and, you know, no game's perfect. Even, you know, even though a game might sell 20 million units, there's still things to discuss and pick apart and say, why did they do this and this and that? And when I hear these discussions around Immortals, you know, the gear system was kind of funky and, you know, this or the, you know, the story, the writing was uneven or things like that. It's like, yeah, right. Okay, let's talk about, that's interesting. Let's talk about that. You know, every game has something about it that is, you know, you're not going to totally agree on or people are going to have issues with. And that's the fun part. That's like, okay, let's pick that apart and figure out what we can do better or why that didn't land or, you know, whatever it is. Like the, you know, the tone, that was a completely deliberate aesthetic choice to go like, you know what, we're going to make a Marvel movie. We're going to do something that you don't see in the fantasy genre that much. We're going to go for Guardians of the Galaxy or Thor Ragnarok or something like that. And man, that, you know, some people love it, some people hate it. And it's just, you know, I didn't realize it would be that much of a firebrand kind of decision. Like, and I'm one of the writers on it. So that was certainly shocking, but then kind of understandable, you know, and it I think that speaks to like what we expect out of writing from a video game.
Yeah. I mean, look, I like the writing in the game. So like, I'm somebody who, like, I understand why people didn't like it, though. Sometimes I find the way it's characterized a bit unfair. I think more it's that if humor doesn't work for you, it's really annoying. But I think the thing that bums me out there is then the safe creative choice becomes making a lot of like solemn plotting, like taking yourself way too seriously type game. Like if this had been another, like, now this, all the shooting action is really awesome, but let's think about how sad this world is. Like, absolutely not. I think part of it is like, the world gets in. It's like, yeah, we're having a good time. Sorry about all them kids at the start of the game. Now let's blow some shit up. And that all works for me. And I think the version of it that's a little bit more like, it's a meditation on like lost innocence. And which, by the way, it still has elements of that. But I think the version of it. I
mean, Rob, there's a structure in the game that just adds the names of the dead as they die. So,
yeah. But yeah, so like it's one of those things where like I think the way people relate to humor helps me sort of understand why maybe the safer bet is to be like, let's take ourselves pretty seriously and like pitch it at more like, like various like solemn fantasy shows and movies.
Well, the safe choice is to make a game where no one talks about the writing. Because you haven't made any kind of risky decision at all. You haven't tried anything. And there's a template out there for what a, you know, an average video game script kind of looks like and feels like, especially in the fantasy genre. And, you know, not terribly interesting to me. Wanted to do something different. Wanted to try something. My, you know, lead writer and myself, we have a great relationship and we have a lot of fun writing together. And we had a lot of fun writing this game. And, you know, yeah, our sense of humor may not land with everyone, but, you know, the game's not even really a comedy. It has some humor in it, but it's got some serious, you know, we meditate on some serious things as well. And again, maybe that's not what people are putting their money down for, but the people that like it really like it and really appreciate it. And that's encouraging. It's heartening to me to see that we connected with some people. I make games to connect with other people, you know, like that's why I do what I do, because games have connected with me throughout my life in a very strong way, in a very meaningful way. And I want to do the same. So when it does land, when it does connect, it's a great feeling, you know, and that's what I was shooting for.
You mentioned the gear system. That was, I think, where some of the concern from some people comes from, is looking at some games that are coming out around this period that you could conceivably look at as, were they chasing sort of live service trends from 5-ish years ago, right? The launch of a Destiny 2. Like, there's plenty of games that we've looked at where they've run into some criticism as they head towards launch, where the live service model has run out a little bit of steam, both in terms of sort of energy from players and also from sort of financially speaking. And so what went into deciding to make like this game, which does have a sort of progression system in terms of what you're unlocking, like sort of like subsets of your powers, but in terms of the weapons that you, and kind of the specifics of it, does have a gear system. How did you arrive at that being something you wanted to add into the game? And I presumably that must be something that, my guess, has changed over the course of development.
Yeah. A lot of the design decisions with Immortals was me having the opportunity to make my own game and put everything in it that I really wanted to put in it. And I really like chasing gear, and I really like being able to customize my character and how to play in a game. It was never going to be around microtransactions or games as a service or anything like that. And I really wasn't deliberately, at least, following a trend like that. I really wanted to make a game where you'd want to find an awesome piece of gear that would be more powerful or change how you play. And I wanted, and you know, the combat team, my combat designers and I wanted to make a game where you could create a build that was very different than another player. And whether or not you engage with it, like, fine, people don't have to actually chase that stuff. You can do, you know, have a lot of fun playing through, but there are builds in the game that are pretty crazy if you actually hunt and put them together. And I like that as a player. I play a lot of like Elden Ring, and I've done lots of different builds in that game. You know, you can create in Immortals a game where you can like melee everything to death in an amazingly effective way that, you know, and no one uses that. No one like just punches people, but you can do it. You can create a build that's like has a lot of damage over time and just melts all the enemies over time, you know, and there's a lot of things in there that I just thought were really entertaining and interesting. They're discoverable. They're things that people could find on a second playthrough. You don't need it. You know, I don't think you need it, but you can, but it's there. It's there as a choice. And I like those kind of player choices. So I think a lot of that was, you know, there wasn't like an overarching, like, this is how it fits into the whole thing. It's more like, this is something I personally enjoy and I want to put it in the game.
I think the first time I realized that was with the green magic, you know, sort of functioning as like the, you know, the rapid fire SMG type weapon, where it's like, I didn't quite realize how much of an impact, like the amount of bullets you could fire in a clip was really going to make that much of a difference. And then I picked one up that just felt like I was firing for 30 seconds, where I am just walking around the arena and just the bullets never quite stop. And I ended up kind of graduating out of that one, and it didn't make sense for like the DPS to continue along that route with that one. But I always like looked back fondly on like the 3 hours that I had with this one, where it was like, I'm just shooting like a Ghostbuster like laser stream with this thing and melting anything that gets across me.
Exactly. Like that's cool to me that you could have that experience. You could focus on red magic and have like a close range berserker, you know, character that's just doing shotgun blast kind of magic constantly. And, it's pretty different. The gameplay is pretty different in that, that, you know, that is fun. And it was fun to make. Like, the combat team really had a lot of fun, like, coming up with all sorts of different builds and talents and way and synergies and things like that. You know, I'm hoping people discover all that, because, you know, there's a lot there that, that we put in, a lot of thought we put into it. What, you know, I think there is a legit criticism to say, well, like, you know, do you need it? Like, what, you know, does a game really require it? And if it doesn't require it, why chase it and why go after it and everything? And I'm not sure what the answer is. You know, would the game have been better not having it, or having that optionality in there and that expression in there? Does that make things deeper and more interesting? It's an interesting design question.
Well, I think, like, something I've enjoyed is the degree to which the character progression system sort of points you back towards different ways of interacting with the core combat systems, of like, hey, you could prioritize this and see how that treats you. And that's been nice. And also just a game where you can sort of, because single player and there's no competitive balance to keep track of, it's just, we can just push things to absurd ends. And you can, like, have your hacky exploit build that, like, completely meshes with what you want to do. And that's great. I'm curious, because I feel like with a lot of games coming from major publishers and studios that work with the major publishers, like, a lot of times the feeling I have is that past the launch window kind of doesn't matter what happens. Like, the Fates game is already decided. The game's fate is already decided by how the publisher feels the launch went, and, like, no mercy or forgiveness, right? Like, if this IP is dead, you know, into the landfill with ET. And that happens fast, is my understanding of like the publisher world, which is always kind of demoralizing, because it's not to say the game ceases to exist and you shouldn't tell people to go play it, but you often do have the understanding that, like, hey, you know, Take-Two or whoever is not going to, like, reconsider based on, like, this game having a nice long tail. Like, the story is done. I am curious if the story could be different for a game like Immortals. You've mentioned now that you're hoping a lot of people give it a shot and it's still selling. And I'm curious whether that's mostly because you're proud of the game and, right, like, want people to play it, or if, you know, because of the way you're situated, there is a chance that, like, if this thing does find some sort of respectable audience, that the story can have a different ending in terms of how Immortals went.
Yeah. I mean, I think, I don't think the story is over with Immortals. I think, you know, I saw this happen. I think I mentioned this before. I saw this happen on Dead Space. It took a while, but it built up over time. There are enough, you know, I've seen both anecdotally and online enough of a sort of fan base growing around this that it's really encouraging to see something like that. I think there are, you know, as far as the world of Avium, there are other areas to explore. And, you know, even if it's not a direct sequel, there could be something else there in that world. And with that, you know, with the things that make this game great, like the combat system. And we're also kind of in a weird position where sales are increasing, not decreasing over time. So that's, you know, that's interesting. I think, you know, as far as my own personal desires, I wanted to make a franchise, and I wanted to make something that could be around for a very long time. And it's a world that I really care a lot about, and characters that I really care a lot about. So, you know, if you ask me if I wanted to do another one, the answer is fuck yeah. I mean, I spent 5 years of my life on this. I put a lot of, you know, myself and a lot of passion, and the whole team did, put a lot of passion behind this. And I love it. You know, I'm very proud of it. So, That is, there's no question, you know, where my ultimate ambitions would lie. It might be 10 years from now, who knows? It might be sooner than that. But the world of AVM is something that I'm very, very passionate about.
Now that the game is in the world, you know, for the last 6 months, has there been anything particularly surprising about what people have responded to? You know, I'm sure you have your expectations of, oh, I think people are going to like this part, or I'm excited for them to see this. And then, you know, you can be surprised by, huh, well, people really latched onto this in a way that I wasn't really expecting. I wonder what you've been surprised by in terms of what people have reacted to in the game.
Yeah. I haven't had a moment like I had on Advanced Warfare where suddenly press F to pay respects was what everyone was talking about. what the hell just happened? And there are more stories about that than there were about the game. So no, that hasn't happened. But getting back to like the tone of the game and like how polarizing that is, that surprised me. Because I thought, like, you know, yeah, you put some jokes in or whatever, you know, yeah, you have a certain type tone. Like, how much are people really going to like care one way or another? They're kind of here for they're here for the combat and the exploration and other things. But no, it's like it really mattered, which is great because like I put a lot of effort into it. And my team did. But
yeah, you got a reaction. Certainly
it got a reaction.
That's more than a lot of games get.
Exactly. Got a reaction. That's cool. And I think, yeah, so tone was a big one. I think it surprised me. It has surprised me how much people didn't know what to make of the game, because to me it was, okay, this is like kind of a Doom-ish shooter with a bunch of exploration elements and some other things thrown in there. The like kind of what we talked about earlier, the sort of like, what is this game reaction was surprising to me. Other than that, I mean,
I didn't mean to convey necessarily things that you're surprised that people were negative about. I actually, like, what were things that people have, like, you know, you've mentioned like sort of a fandom, like people like I was thinking more in the sort of the positive realm of like things like, oh, wow, like people have really latched on to this part of the world in a way that was not necessarily, you know, on my bingo card.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always great to see what characters resonated. You know, I think seeing how, like, you know, Gina Torres's character, Kirkin, got, you know, there's a lot of talk around her and a lot of fandom around her, which is awesome. She's awesome. She was great in the game. She was great to work with. That is a pleasant surprise when a character really lands that you spend a lot of time on. Honestly, like, making a great combat system is really, really hard to do. And the fact that the overwhelming response has been that the combat's really fun and that people have a great time with it, like, that is huge to me. That's bigger than I expected. I thought it would be a piece of many pieces that would, you know, like the sum being greater, the whole being greater than the sum of the parts, you know, like it was a piece, but that has resonated so much. And that's really fucking hard to do to make a good combat system and do something new. And so I'm really proud of that. That, like, that on the positive side, how well that resonated and how well the world building has resonated, because we spend a lot of time on that too. And that this is a world that people want to return to and are bought in on. You know, that was really important to us. So yeah, those things feel good, feel really good.
Well, I think we have taken up a decent chunk of your time. Is there anything else that you want to convey about the game to people? Like, where can they check? Like, you said it's on sale now. Is the trial still available? Like, where can you point people towards in terms of checking the game out?
Yeah, the trial is available. I think it's permanent, actually. So you can always do a free trial of the game on PlayStation and Xbox, and I think there's a free demo on Steam as well. I mean, I would just, you know, ask people to give it a shot. You know, it's a really good game, and it's something I'm really proud of and something I'm really passionate about. It is different. And I think different is really, really important right now. I think we see a lot of the same, and we tried something different, and that's important. That's huge. So, you know, we are, you know, as a studio, we have new projects we're lining up. We're, you know, we are actively working on things that I can't talk about, but that are really cool. And, you know, I think we introduced ourselves to the world in a strong way.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank you for your time. It is unusual to have a developer that goes through the sort of tumultuous launch that you did in the way that it did, and to sit and chat with us about your feelings and thoughts and reactions to that. So, you know, on behalf of ourselves and the Remap audience, appreciate your time and your honesty and being able to talk about it. Because usually I feel like it's understandable that you want to just move on to the next thing, not sit with that. And I'm sure you're doing both of those things, but to be able to convey that to the audience, what it is like to, you know, have gone through these 5 years and what that means for the future. I appreciate you taking the time to chat with us about it.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it. This was a lot of fun.
All right. Take care. Thanks, Brett.
Thank you.